Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand, continued, Disc 3. Seven executives of the electrical industry were sentenced to jail. We shall never know what went on behind the scenes of this case, or in the negotiations between the companies and the government. Were these seven responsible for the alleged conspiracy? If it be guilt, were they guiltier than others? Who informed on them, and why? Were they framed? Were they double-crossed? Whose purposes, ambitions, or goals were served by their immolation? We do not know. Under a setup such as the antitrust laws have created, there is no way to know. When these seven men, who could not defend themselves, came into the courtroom to hear their sentences, their lawyers addressed the judge with pleas for mercy. I quote from the same story in Time. First before the court came the lawyer for a vice president of Westinghouse to plead for mercy. His client, said the lawyer, was a vestryman of St. John's Episcopal Church in Sharon, Pennsylvania, and a benefactor of charities for crippled children. Another defendant's lawyer pleaded that his client was the director of a boys' club in Schenectady, New York, and the chairman of a campaign to build a new Jesuit seminary in Lenox, Massachusetts. It was not these men's achievements, or their productive ability, or their executive talent, or their intelligence, or their rights that their lawyers found it necessary to cite, but their altruistic service to the welfare of the needy. The needy had a right to welfare, but those who produced and provided it had not. The welfare and the rights of the producers were not regarded as worthy of consideration or recognition. This is the most damning indictment of the present state of our culture. The final touch on that whole gruesome farce was Judge Ganey's statement. He said, "What is really at stake here is the survival of the kind of economy under which America has grown to greatness, the free enterprise system." He said it while delivering the most staggering blow that the free enterprise system had ever sustained, while sentencing to jail seven of its best representatives, and thus declaring that the very class of men who brought America to greatness, the businessmen, are now to be treated by their nature and profession as criminals. In the person of these seven men, it is the free enterprise system that he was sentencing. These seven men were martyrs. They were treated as sacrificial animals. They were human sacrifices, as truly and more cruelly than the human sacrifices offered by prehistorical savages in the jungle. If you care about justice to minority groups, remember that businessmen are a small minority, a very small minority, compared to the total of all the uncivilized hordes on earth. Remember how much you owe to this minority, and what disgraceful persecution it is enduring. Remember also that the smallest minority on earth is the individual. Those who deny individual rights cannot claim to be defenders of minorities. What should we do about it? We should demand a re-examination and revision of the entire issue of antitrust. We should challenge its philosophical, political, economic, and moral base. We should have a civil liberties union for businessmen. The repeal of the antitrust laws should be our ultimate goal. It will require a long intellectual and political struggle. But in the meantime, and as a first step, we should demand that the jail penalty provisions of these laws be abolished. It is bad enough if men have to suffer financial penalties, such as fines, under laws which everyone concedes to be non-objective, contradictory, and undefinable, since no two jurists can agree on their meaning and application. It is obscene to impose prison sentences under laws of so controversial a nature. We should put an end to the outrage of sending men to jail for breaking unintelligible laws which they cannot avoid breaking. Businessmen are the one group that distinguishes capitalism and the American way of life from the totalitarian statism that is swallowing the rest of the world. All the other social groups, workers, farmers, professional men, scientists, soldiers, exist under dictatorships, even though they exist in chains, in terror, in misery, and in progressive self-destruction. But there is no such group as businessmen under a dictatorship. their places taken by armed thugs, by bureaucrats and commissars. Businessmen are the symbol of a free society, the symbol of America. If and when they perish, civilization will perish. But if you wish to fight for freedom, you must begin by fighting for its unrewarded, unrecognized, unacknowledged, yet best representatives, the American businessmen. Chapter 4, Antitrust, by Alan Greenspan. The world of antitrust is reminiscent of Alice's Wonderland. Everything seemingly is, yet apparently isn't, simultaneously. It is a world in which competition is lauded as the basic axiom and guiding principle, yet too much competition is condemned as cutthroat. It is a world in which actions designed to limit competition are branded as criminal when taken by businessmen, yet praised as enlightened when initiated by the government. It is a world in which the law is so vague that businessmen have no way of knowing whether specific actions will be declared illegal until they hear the judge's verdict after the fact. In view of the confusion, contradictions, and legalistic hair-splitting which characterize the realm of antitrust, I submit that the entire antitrust system must be opened for review. It is necessary to ascertain and to estimate A. the historical roots of the antitrust laws, and B. the economic theories upon which these laws were based. Americans have always feared the concentration of arbitrary power in the hands of politicians. Prior to the Civil War, few attributed such power to businessmen. It was recognized that government officials had the legal power to compel obedience by the use of physical force, and that businessmen had no such power. A businessman needed customers. He had to appeal to their self-interest. This appraisal of the issue changed rapidly in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, particularly with the coming of the railroad age. Outwardly, the railroads did not have the backing of legal force, but to the farmers of the West, the railroads seemed to hold the arbitrary power previously ascribed solely to the government. The railroads appeared unhampered by the laws of competition. They seemed able to charge rates calculated to keep the farmers in seed grain, no higher, no lower. The farmers' protest took the form of the National Grange Movement, the organization responsible for the passage of the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887. The industrial giants such as Rockefeller's Standard Oil Trust, which were rising during this period, were also alleged to be immune from competition, from the law of supply and demand. The public reaction against the trusts culminated in the Sherman Act of 1890. It was claimed then, as it is still claimed today, that business, if left free, would necessarily develop into an institution vested with arbitrary power. Is this assertion valid? Did the post-Civil War period give birth to a new form of arbitrary power, or did the government remain the source of such power, with business merely providing a new avenue through which it could be exercised? This is the crucial historical question. The railroads developed in the East prior to the Civil War in stiff competition with one another, as well as with the older forms of transportation, barges, riverboats, and wagons. By the 1860s, there arose a political clamor demanding that the railroads move west and tie California to the nation. National prestige was held to be at stake. But the traffic volume outside of the populous East was insufficient to draw commercial transportation westward. The potential profit did not warrant the heavy cost of investment in transportation facilities. In the name of public policy, it was therefore decided to subsidize the railroads in their move to the West. Between 1863 and 1867, close to 100 million acres of public lands were granted to the railroads. Since these grants were made to individual roads, no competing railroads could vie for traffic in the same area in the West. Meanwhile, the alternative forms of competition, wagons, river boats, etc., could not afford to challenge the railroads in the West. Thus, with the aid of the federal government, a segment of the railroad industry was able to break free from the competitive bounds which had prevailed in the East. As might be expected, the subsidies attracted the kind of promoters who always exist on the fringe of the business community, and who are constantly seeking an easy deal. Many of the new Western railroads were shabbily built. They were not constructed to carry traffic, but to acquire land grants. The Western railroads were true monopolies in the textbook sense of the word. They could and did behave with an aura of arbitrary power. But that power was not derived from a free market. It stemmed from governmental subsidies and governmental restrictions. When, ultimately, Western traffic increased to levels which could support other profit-making transportation carriers, the railroad's monopolistic power was soon undercut. In spite of their initial privileges, they were unable to withstand the pressure of free competition. In the meantime, however, an ominous turning point had taken place in our economic history: the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887. That act was not necessitated by the evils of a free market. Like subsequent legislation controlling business, the act was an attempt to remedy the economic distortions which prior government interventions had created, but which were blamed on the free market. The Interstate Commerce Act, in turn, produced new distortions in the structure and finances of the railroads. Today, it is proposed that these distortions be corrected by means of further subsidies. The railroads are on the verge of final collapse, yet no one challenges the original misdiagnosis to discover and correct the actual cause of their illness. To interpret the railroad history of the 19th century as proof of the failure of a free market is a disastrous error. The same error which persists to this day was the 19th century's fear of the trusts. The most formidable of the trusts was Standard Oil. Nevertheless, at the time of the passage of the Sherman Act, a pre-automotive period, the entire petroleum industry amounted to less than 1% of the gross national product and was barely one-third as large as the shoe industry. It was not the absolute size of the trust, but their dominance within their own industries that gave rise to apprehension. What the observers failed to grasp, however, was the fact that the control by Standard Oil at the turn of the century of more than 80% of refining capacity made economic sense and accelerated the growth of the American economy. Such control yielded obvious gains in efficiency through the integration of divergent refining, marketing, and pipeline operations. It also made the raising of capital easier and cheaper. Trusts came into existence because they were the most efficient units in those industries which, being relatively new, were too small to support more than one large company. Historically, the general development of industry has taken the following course. An industry begins with a few small firms. In time, many of them merge. This increases efficiency and augments profits. As the market expands, new firms enter the field, thus cutting down the share of the market held by the dominant firm. This has been the pattern in steel, oil, aluminum, containers, and numerous other major industries. The observable tendency of an industry's dominant companies eventually to lose part of their share of the market is not caused by antitrust legislation, but by the fact that it is difficult to prevent new firms from entering the field when the demand for a certain product increases. Texaco and Gulf, for example, would have grown into large firms even if the original Standard Oil Trust had not been dissolved. Similarly, the United States Steel Corporation's dominance of the steel industry half a century ago would have been eroded with or without the Sherman Act. It takes extraordinary skill to hold more than 50% of a large industry's market in a free economy. It requires unusual productive ability, unfailing business judgment, unrelenting effort at the continuous improvement of one's product and technique. The rare company which is able to retain its share of the market year after year and decade after decade does so by means of productive efficiency and deserves praise, not condemnation. The Sherman Act may be understandable when viewed as a projection of the 19th century's fear and economic ignorance, but it is utter nonsense in the context of today's economic knowledge. The 70 additional years of observing industrial development should have taught us something. If the attempts to justify our antitrust statutes on historical grounds are erroneous and rest on a misinterpretation of history, the attempts to justify them on theoretical grounds come from a still more fundamental misconception. In the early days of the United States, Americans enjoyed a large measure of economic freedom. Each individual was free to produce what he chose and sell to whomever he chose at a price mutually agreed upon. If two competitors concluded that it was to their mutual self-interest to set joint price policies, they were free to do so. If a customer requested a rebate in exchange for his business, a firm, usually a railroad, could comply or deny as it saw fit. According to classical economics, which had a profound influence on the 19th century, competition would keep the economy in balance. But while many theories of the classical economists, such as their description of the working of a free economy, were valid, their concept of competition was ambiguous and led to confusion in the minds of their followers. It was understood to mean that competition consists merely of producing and selling the maximum possible, like a robot, passively accepting the market price as a law of nature, never making any attempt to influence the conditions of the market. The businessmen of the latter half of the 19th century, however, aggressively attempted to affect the conditions of their markets by advertising, varying production rates, and bargaining on price with suppliers and customers. Many observers assumed that these activities were incompatible with the classical theory. They concluded that competition was no longer working effectively. In the sense in which they understood competition, it had never worked or existed, except possibly in some isolated agricultural markets. But in a meaningful sense of the word, competition did and does exist, in the 19th century as well as today. Competition is an active, not a passive noun. It applies to the entire sphere of economic activity, not merely to production, but also to trade. It implies the necessity of taking action to affect the conditions of the market in one's own favor. The error of the 19th century observers was that they restricted a wide abstraction, competition, to a narrow set of particulars, to the passive competition projected by their own interpretation of classical economics. As a result, they concluded that the alleged failure of this fictitious passive competition negated the entire theoretical structure of classical economics, including the demonstration of the fact that laissez-faire is the most efficient and productive of all possible economic systems. They concluded that a free market, by its nature, leads to its own destruction, and they came to the grotesque contradiction of attempting to preserve the freedom of the market by government controls, i.e. to preserve the benefits of laissez-faire by abrogating it. The crucial question which they failed to ask is whether active competition does inevitably lead to the establishment of coercive monopolies, as they supposed, or whether a laissez-faire economy of active competition has a built-in regulator which protects and preserves it. That is the question which we must now examine. A coercive monopoly is a business concern that can set its prices and production policies independent of the market, with immunity from competition, from the law of supply and demand. An economy dominated by such monopolies would be rigid and stagnant. The necessary precondition of a coercive monopoly is a closed entry, the barring of all competing producers from a given field. This can be accomplished only by an act of government intervention in the form of special regulations, subsidies, or franchises. Without government assistance, it is impossible for a would-be monopolist to set and maintain his prices and production policies independent of the rest of the economy. For if he attempted to set his prices and production at a level that would yield profits to new entrants significantly above those available in other fields, competitors would be sure to invade his industry. The ultimate regulator of competition in a free economy is the capital market. So long as capital is free to flow, it will tend to seek those areas which offer the maximum rate of return. The potential investor of capital does not merely consider the actual rate of return earned by companies within a specific industry. His decision concerning where to invest depends on what he himself could earn in that particular line. The existing profit rates within an industry are calculated in terms of existing costs. He has to consider the fact that a new entrant might not be able to achieve at once as low a cost structure as that of experienced producers. Therefore, the existence of a free capital market does not guarantee that a monopolist who enjoys high profits will necessarily and immediately find himself confronted by competition. What it does guarantee is that a monopolist whose high profits are caused by high prices rather than low costs will soon meet competition originated by the capital market. The capital market acts as a regulator of prices, not necessarily of profits. It leaves an individual producer free to earn as much as he can by lowering his costs and by increasing his efficiency relative to others. Thus, it constitutes the mechanism that generates greater incentives to increased productivity and leads as a consequence to a rising standard of living. The history of the Aluminum Company of America prior to World War II illustrates the process. Envisaging its self-interest and long-term profitability in terms of a growing market, Alcoa kept the price of primary aluminum at a level compatible with the maximum expansion of its market. At such a price level, however, profits were forthcoming only by means of tremendous efforts to step up efficiency and productivity. Alcoa was a monopoly, the only producer of primary aluminum, but it was not a coercive monopoly, i.e., it could not set its price and production policies independent of the competitive world. In fact, only because the company stressed cost-cutting and efficiency rather than raising prices was it able to maintain its position as sole producer of primary aluminum for so long. Had Alcoa attempted to increase its profits by raising prices, it soon would have found itself competing with new entrants in the primary aluminum business. In analyzing the competitive processes of a laissez-faire economy, one must recognize that capital outlays, investments in new plant and equipment, either by existing producers or new entrants, are not determined solely by current profits. An investment is made or not made depending upon the estimated discounted present worth of expected future profits. Consequently, the issue of whether or not a new competitor will enter a hitherto monopolistic industry is determined by his expected future returns. The present worth of the discounted expected future profits of a given industry is represented by the market price of the common stock of the companies in that industry. If the price of a particular company's stock, or an average for a particular industry, rises, the move implies a higher present worth for expected future earnings. Statistical evidence demonstrates the correlation between stock prices and capital outlays, not only for industry as a whole, but also within major industry groups. Moreover, the time between the fluctuations of stock prices and the corresponding fluctuations of capital expenditures is rather short, a fact which implies that the process of relating new capital investments to profit expectations is relatively fast. If such a correlation works as well as it does, considering today's governmental impediments to the free movement of capital, one must conclude that in a completely free market, the process would be much more efficient. The churning of a nation's capital in a fully free economy would be continuously pushing capital into profitable areas, and this would effectively control the competitive price and production policies of business firms, making a coercive monopoly impossible to maintain. It is only in a so-called mixed economy that a coercive monopoly can flourish, protected from the discipline of the capital markets by franchises, subsidies, and special privileges from governmental regulators. To sum up, the entire structure of antitrust statutes in this country is a jumble of economic irrationality and ignorance. It is the product, A, of a gross misinterpretation of history, and B, of rather naive and certainly unrealistic economic theories. As a last resort, some people argue that at least the antitrust laws haven't done any harm. They assert that even though the competitive process itself inhibits coercive monopolies, there is no harm in making doubly sure by declaring certain economic actions to be illegal. But the very existence of those undefinable statutes and contradictory case law inhibits businessmen from undertaking what would otherwise be sound, productive ventures. No one will ever know what new products, processes, machines, and cost-saving mergers failed to come into existence, killed by the Sherman Act before they were born. No one can ever compute the price that all of us have paid for that act, which by inducing less effective use of capital has kept our standard of living lower than would otherwise have been possible. No speculation, however, is required to assess the injustice and the damage to the careers, reputations, and lives of business executives jailed under the antitrust laws. Those who allege that the purpose of the antitrust laws is to protect competition, enterprise, and efficiency need to be reminded of the following quotation from Judge Learned Hand's indictment of Alcoa's so-called monopolistic practices. It was not inevitable that it should always anticipate increases in the demand for ingot and be prepared to supply them. Nothing compelled it to keep doubling and redoubling its capacity before others entered the field. It insists that it never excluded competitors. But we can think of no more effective exclusion than progressively to embrace each new opportunity as it opened, and to face every newcomer with new capacity, already geared into a great organization, having the advantage of experience, trade connections, and the elite of personnel. Alcoa is being condemned for being too successful, too efficient, and too good a competitor. Whatever damage the antitrust laws may have done to our economy, whatever distortions of the structure of the nation's capital they may have created, these are less disastrous than the fact that the effective purpose, the hidden intent, and the actual practice of the antitrust laws in the United States have led to the condemnation of the productive and efficient members of our society because they are productive and efficient. Chapter 5, Common Fallacies About Capitalism, by Nathaniel Brandon. Monopolies. In a society of laissez-faire capitalism, what would prevent the formation of powerful monopolies able to gain control over the entire economy? One of the worst fallacies in the field of economics, propagated by Karl Marx and accepted by almost everyone today, including many businessmen, is the notion that the development of monopolies is an inescapable and intrinsic result of the operation of a free, unregulated economy. In fact, the exact opposite is true. It is a free market that makes monopolies impossible. It is imperative that one be clear and specific in one's definition of monopoly. When people speak, in an economic or political context, of the dangers and evils of monopoly, what they mean is a coercive monopoly, i.e., exclusive control of a given field of production, which is closed to and exempt from competition, so that those controlling the field are able to set arbitrary production policies and charge arbitrary prices, independent of the market, immune from the law of supply and demand. Such a monopoly, it is important to note, entails more than the absence of competition. It entails the impossibility of competition. That is a coercive monopoly's characteristic attribute, which is essential to any condemnation of such a monopoly. In the entire history of capitalism, no one has been able to establish a coercive monopoly by means of competition on a free market. There is only one way to forbid entry into a given field of production: by law. Every coercive monopoly that exists or has ever existed in the United States, in Europe, or anywhere else in the world was created and made possible only by an act of government, by special franchises, licenses, subsidies, by legislative actions which granted special privileges, not obtainable on a free market, to a man or a group of men, and forbade all others to enter that particular field. A coercive monopoly is not the result of laissez-faire. It can result only from the abrogation of laissez-faire and from the introduction of the opposite principle, the principle of statism. In this country, a utility company is a coercive monopoly. The government grants it a franchise for an exclusive territory, and no one else is allowed to engage in that service in that territory. A would-be competitor attempting to sell electric power would be stopped by law. A telephone company is a coercive monopoly. As recently as World War II, The government ordered the two then existing telegraph companies, Western Union and Postal Telegraph, to merge into one monopoly. In the comparatively free days of American capitalism, in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were many attempts to corner the market on various commodities, such as cotton and wheat, to mention two famous examples, then close the field to competition and gather huge profits by selling at exorbitant prices. All such attempts failed. The men who tried it were compelled to give up or go bankrupt. They were defeated not by legislative action, but by the action of the free market. The question is often asked, what if a large rich company kept buying out its smaller competitors, or kept forcing them out of business by means of undercutting prices and selling at a loss? Would it not be able to gain control of a given field, and then start charging high prices, and be free to stagnate with no fear of competition? The answer is no, it could not be done. If a company assumed heavy losses in order to drive out competitors, then began to charge high prices to regain what it had lost, this would serve as an incentive for new competitors to enter the field and take advantage of the high profitability, without any losses to recoup. The new competitors would force prices down to the market level. The large company would have to abandon its attempt to establish monopoly prices or go bankrupt, fighting off the competitors that its own policies would attract. It is a matter of historical fact that no price war has ever succeeded in establishing a monopoly or in maintaining prices above the market level, outside the law of supply and demand. Price wars have, however, acted as spurs to the economic efficiency of competing companies and have thereby resulted in enormous benefits to the public in terms of better products at lower prices. In considering this issue, people frequently ignore the crucial role of the capital market in a free economy. As Alan Greenspan observes in his article Antitrust, if entry into a given field of production is not impeded by government regulations, franchises, or subsidies, the ultimate regulator of competition in a free economy is the capital market. So long as capital is free to flow, it will tend to seek those areas which offer the maximum rate of return. Investors are constantly seeking the most profitable uses of their capital. If, therefore, some field of production is seen to be highly profitable, particularly when the profitability is due to high prices rather than to low costs, businessmen and investors necessarily will be attracted to that field. And as the supply of the product in question is increased relative to the demand for it, prices fall accordingly. The capital market, writes Mr. Greenspan, acts as a regulator of prices, not necessarily of profits. It leaves an individual producer free to earn as much as he can by lowering his costs and by increasing his efficiency relative to others. Thus, it constitutes the mechanism that generates greater incentives to increased productivity and leads as a consequence to a rising standard of living. The free market does not permit inefficiency or stagnation with economic impunity in any field of production. Consider, for instance, a well-known incident in the history of the American automobile industry. There was a period when Henry Ford's Model T held an enormous part of the automobile market. But when Ford's company attempted to stagnate and to resist stylistic changes, you can have any color of the Model T you want so long as it's black. General Motors, with its more attractively styled Chevrolet, cut into a major segment of Ford's market, and the Ford company was compelled to change its policies in order to compete. One will find examples of this principle in the history of virtually every industry. Now, if one considers the only kind of monopoly that can exist under capitalism, a non-coercive monopoly, one will see that its prices and production policies are not independent of the wider market in which it operates, but are fully bound by the law of supply and demand. That there is no particular reason for or value in retaining the designation of monopoly when one uses it in a non-coercive sense, and that there are no rational grounds on which to condemn such monopolies. For instance, if a small town has only one drugstore which is barely able to survive, the owner might be described as enjoying a monopoly, except that no one would think of using the term in this context. There is no economic need or market for a second drugstore. There is not enough trade to support it. But if that town grew, its one drugstore would have no way, no power to prevent other drugstores from being opened. It is often thought that the field of mining is particularly vulnerable to the establishment of monopolies, since the materials extracted from the earth exist in limited quantity, and since it is believed some firm might gain control of all the sources of some raw material. But observe that International Nickel of Canada produces more than two-thirds of the world's nickel, yet it does not charge monopoly prices. It prices its product as though it had a great many competitors, and the truth is that it does have a great many competitors. Nickel, in the form of alloy and stainless steels, is competing with aluminum and a variety of other materials. The seldom recognized principle involved in such cases is that no single product, commodity, or material is or can be indispensable to an economy, regardless of price. A commodity can be only relatively preferable to other commodities. For example, when the price of bituminous coal rose, which was due to John L. Lewis's forcing an economically unjustified wage raise, this was instrumental in bringing about a large-scale conversion to the use of oil and gas in many industries. The free market is its own protector. Now, if a company were able to gain and hold a non-coercive monopoly, if it were able to win all the customers in a given field, not by special government-granted privileges, but by sheer productive efficiency, by its ability to keep its costs low and or to offer a better product than any competitor could, there would be no grounds on which to condemn such a monopoly. On the contrary, the company that achieved it would deserve the highest praise and esteem. No one can morally claim the right to compete in a given field if he cannot match the productive efficiency of those with whom he hopes to compete. There is no reason why people should buy inferior products at higher prices in order to maintain less efficient companies in business. Under capitalism, any man or company that can surpass competitors is free to do so. It is in this manner that the free market rewards ability and works for the benefit of everyone, except those who seek the undeserved. A bromide commonly cited in this connection by capitalism's opponents is the story of the old corner grocer who is driven out of business by the big chain store. What is the clear implication of their protest? Is it that the people who live in the neighborhood of the old grocer have to continue buying from him, even though a chain store could give them better service at lower prices and thereby let them save money? Thus, both the owners of the chain store and the people in the neighborhood are to be penalized in order to protect the stagnation of the old grocer. By what right? If that grocer is unable to compete with the chain stores, then properly he has no choice but to move elsewhere or go into another line of business or seek employment from the chain store. Capitalism, by its nature, entails a constant process of motion, of growth, of progress. No one has a vested right to a position if others can do better than he can. When people denounce the free market as cruel, the fact they are decrying is that the market is ruled by a single moral principle, justice, and that is the root of their hatred for capitalism. There is only one kind of monopoly that men may rightfully condemn, the only kind for which the designation of monopoly is economically significant, a coercive monopoly. Observe that in the non-coercive meaning of the term, every man may be described as a monopolist, since he is the exclusive owner of his effort and product. But this is not regarded as evil, except by socialists. In the issue of monopolies, as in so many other issues, capitalism is commonly blamed for the evils perpetrated by its destroyers. It is not free trade on a free market that creates coercive monopolies, but government legislation, government action, government controls. If men are concerned about the evils of monopolies, let them identify the actual villain in the picture and the actual cause of the evils. Government intervention into the economy. Let them recognize that there is only one way to destroy monopolies, by the separation of state and economics. That is, by instituting the principle that the government may not abridge the freedom of production and trade. June 1962. Depressions. Are periodic depressions inevitable in a system of laissez-faire capitalism? It is a characteristic of the enemies of capitalism that they denounce it for evils which are, in fact, the result not of capitalism but of statism. Evils which result from and are made possible only by government intervention in the economy. I have discussed a flagrant example of this policy, the charge that capitalism leads to the establishment of coercive monopolies. The most notorious instance of this policy is the claim that capitalism, by its nature, inevitably leads to periodic depressions. Statists repeatedly assert that depressions, the phenomenon of the so-called business cycle of boom and bust, are inherent in laissez-faire, and that the Great Crash of 1929 was the final proof of the failure of an unregulated free market economy. What is the truth of the matter? A depression is a large-scale decline in production and trade. It is characterized by a sharp drop in productive output, in investment, in employment, and in the value of capital assets, plants, machinery, etc. Normal business fluctuations or a temporary decline in the rate of industrial expansion do not constitute a depression. A depression is a nationwide contraction of business activity and a general decline in the value of capital assets of major proportions. There is nothing in the nature of a free market economy to cause such an event. The popular explanations of depression as caused by overproduction, underconsumption, monopolies, labor-saving devices, maldistribution, excessive accumulations of wealth, etc., have been exploded as fallacies many times. Readjustments of economic activity, shifts of capital and labor from one industry to another due to changing conditions, occur constantly under capitalism. This is entailed in the process of motion, growth, and progress that characterizes capitalism. But there always exists the possibility of profitable endeavor in one field or another. There is always the need and demand for goods, and all that can change is the kind of goods it becomes most profitable to produce. In any one industry, it is possible for supply to exceed demand, in the context of all the other existing demands. In such a case, there is a drop in prices, in profitableness, in investment, and in employment in that particular industry. Capital and labor tend to flow elsewhere, seeking more rewarding uses. Such an industry undergoes a period of stagnation as a result of unjustified, that is, uneconomic, unprofitable, unproductive investment. In a free economy that functions on a gold standard, such unproductive investment is severely limited. Unjustified speculation does not rise unchecked until it engulfs an entire nation. In a free economy, the supply of money and credit needed to finance business ventures is determined by objective economic factors. It is the banking system that acts as the guardian of economic stability. The principles governing money supply operate to forbid large-scale unjustified investment. Most businesses finance their undertakings, at least in part, by means of bank loans. Banks function as an investment clearinghouse, investing the savings of their customers in those enterprises which promise to be most successful. Banks do not have unlimited funds to loan. They are limited in the credit they can extend by the amount of their gold reserves. In order to remain successful, to make profits, and thus attract the savings of investors, banks must make their loans judiciously. They must seek out those ventures which they judge to be most sound and potentially profitable. If, in a period of increasing speculation, banks are confronted with an inordinate number of requests for loans, then in response to the shrinking availability of money, they A. raise their interest rates, and B. scrutinize more severely the ventures for which loans are requested, setting more exacting standards of what constitutes a justifiable investment. As a consequence, funds are more difficult to obtain, and there is a temporary curtailment and contraction of business investment. Businessmen are often unable to borrow the funds they desire and have to reduce plans for expansion. The purchase of common stocks, which reflects the investors' estimates of the future earnings of companies, is similarly curtailed. Overvalued stocks fall in price. Businesses engaged in uneconomic ventures, now unable to obtain additional credit, are obliged to close their doors. A further waste of productive factors is stopped and economic errors are liquidated. At worst, the economy may experience a mild recession, i.e., a slight general decline in investment and production. In an unregulated economy, readjustments occur quite swiftly, and then production and investment begin to rise again. The temporary recession is not harmful, but beneficial. It represents an economic system in the process of correcting its errors, of curtailing disease and returning to health. The impact of such a recession may be significantly felt in a few industries, but it does not wreck an entire economy. A nationwide depression, such as occurred in the United States in the 30s, would not have been possible in a fully free society. It was made possible only by government intervention in the economy, more specifically by government manipulation of the money supply. The government's policy consisted, in essence, of anesthetizing the regulators inherent in a free banking system that prevent runaway speculation and consequent economic collapse. All government intervention in the economy is based on the belief that economic laws need not operate, that principles of cause and effect can be suspended, that everything in existence is flexible and malleable except a bureaucrat's whim, which is omnipotent. Reality, logic, and economics must not be allowed to get in the way. This was the implicit premise that led to the establishment in 1913 of the Federal Reserve System, an institution with control through complex and often indirect means over the individual banks throughout the country. The Federal Reserve undertook to free individual banks from the limitations imposed on them by the amount of their own individual reserves, to free them from the laws of the market, and to arrogate to government officials the right to decide how much credit they wish to make available at what times. A cheap money policy was the guiding idea and goal of these officials. Banks were no longer to be limited in making loans by the amount of their gold reserves. Interest rates were no longer to rise in response to increasing speculation and increasing demands for funds. Credit was to remain readily available until and unless the Federal Reserve decided otherwise. The government argued that by taking control of money and credit out of the hands of private bankers, and by contracting or expanding credit at will, guided by considerations other than those influencing the selfish bankers, it could, in conjunction with other interventionist policies, so control investment as to guarantee a state of virtually constant prosperity. Many bureaucrats believed that the government could keep the economy in a state of unending boom. To borrow an invaluable metaphor from Alan Greenspan, if, under laissez-faire, the banking system and the principles controlling the availability of funds act as a fuse that prevents a blowout in the economy, then the government, through the Federal Reserve System, put a penny in the fuse box. The result was the explosion known as the Crash of 1929. Throughout most of the 1920s, the government compelled banks to keep interest rates artificially and uneconomically low. As a consequence, money was poured into every sort of speculative venture. By 1928, the warning signals of danger were clearly apparent. Unjustified investment was rampant, and stocks were increasingly overvalued. The government chose to ignore these danger signals. A free banking system would have been compelled by economic necessity to put the brakes on this process of runaway speculation. Credit and investment in such a case would be drastically curtailed. The banks which made unprofitable investments, the enterprises which proved unproductive, and those who dealt with them would suffer. But that would be all. The country as a whole would not be dragged down. However, the anarchy of a free banking system had been abandoned in favor of enlightened government planning. The boom and the wild speculation which had preceded every major depression were allowed to rise unchecked, involving in a widening network of malinvestments and miscalculations the entire economic structure of the nation. People were investing in virtually everything and making fortunes overnight on paper. Profits were calculated on hysterically exaggerated appraisals of the future earnings of companies. Credit was extended with promiscuous abandon, on the premise that somehow the goods would be there to back it up. It was like the policy of a man who passes out rubber checks, counting on the hope that he will somehow find a way to obtain the necessary money and to deposit it in the bank before anyone presents his checks for collection. But A is A, and reality is not infinitely elastic. In 1929, the country's economic and financial structure had become impossibly precarious. By the time the government finally and frantically raised the interest rates, it was too late. It is doubtful whether anyone can state with certainty what events first set off the panic. And it does not matter. The crash had become inevitable. Any number of events could have pulled the trigger. But when the news of the first bank and commercial failures began to spread, uncertainty swept across the country in widening waves of terror. People began to sell their stocks, hoping to get out of the market with their gains, or to obtain the money they suddenly needed to pay bank loans that were being called in. And other people, seeing this, apprehensively began to sell their stocks. And virtually overnight, an avalanche hurled the stock market downward. Prices collapsed, securities became worthless, loans were called in, many of which could not be paid. The value of capital assets plummeted sickeningly. Fortunes were wiped out, and by 1932, business activity had come almost to a halt. The law of causality had avenged itself. Such, in essence, was the nature and cause of the 1929 Depression. It provides one of the most eloquent illustrations of the disastrous consequences of a planned economy. In a free economy, when an individual businessman makes an error of economic judgment, he, and perhaps those who immediately deal with him, suffers the consequences. In a controlled economy, when a central planner makes an error of economic judgment, the whole country suffers the consequences. But it was not the Federal Reserve, it was not the government intervention that took the blame for the 1929 Depression. It was capitalism. Freedom, cried statists of every breed and sect, had its chance and had failed. The voices of the new thinkers who pointed to the real cause of the evil were drowned out in the denunciations of businessmen, of the profit motive, of capitalism. Had men chosen to understand the cause of the crash, the country would have been spared much of the agony that followed. The Depression was prolonged for tragically unnecessary years by the same evil that had caused it: government controls and regulations. Contrary to popular misconception, controls and regulations began long before the New Deal. In the 1920s, the mixed economy was already an established fact of American life. But the trend toward statism began to move faster under the Hoover administration. And with the advent of Roosevelt's New Deal, it accelerated at an unprecedented rate. The economic adjustments needed to bring the Depression to an end were prevented from taking place by the imposition of strangling controls, increased taxes, and labor legislation. This last had the effect of forcing wage rates to unjustifiably high levels, thus raising the businessman's costs at precisely the time when costs needed to be lowered, if investment and production were to revive. The National Industrial Recovery Act, the Wagner Act, and the abandonment of the gold standard, with the government's subsequent plunge into inflation and an orgy of deficit spending, were only three of the many disastrous measures enacted by the New Deal for the avowed purpose of pulling the country out of the Depression. All had the opposite effect. As Alan Greenspan points out in Stock Prices and Capital Evaluation, the obstacle to business recovery did not consist exclusively of the specific New Deal legislation passed. More harmful still was the general atmosphere of uncertainty engendered by the administration. Men had no way to know what law or regulation would descend on their heads at any moment. They had no way to know what sudden shifts of direction government policy might take. They had no way to plan long range. To act and produce, businessmen require knowledge, the possibility of rational calculation, not faith and hope. Above all, not faith and hope concerning the unpredictable twistings within a bureaucrat's head. Such advances as business was able to achieve under the New Deal collapsed in 1937 as a result of an intensification of uncertainty regarding what the government might choose to do next. Unemployment rose to more than 10 million and business activity fell almost to the low point of 1932, the worst year of the Depression. It is part of the official New Deal mythology that Roosevelt got us out of the Depression. How was the problem of the Depression finally solved? By the favorite expedient of all statists in times of emergency, a war. The Depression precipitated by the stock market crash of 1929 was not the first in American history, though it was incomparably more severe than any that had preceded it. If one studies the earlier depressions, the same basic cause and common denominator will be found, in one form or another, by one means or another, government manipulation of the money supply. It is typical of the manner in which interventionism grows that the Federal Reserve System was instituted as a proposed antidote against those earlier depressions, which were themselves products of monetary manipulation by the government. The financial mechanism of an economy is the sensitive center, the living heart, of business activity. In no other area can government intervention produce quite such disastrous consequences. For a general discussion of the business cycle and its relation to government manipulation of the money supply, see Ludwig von Mises, Human Action. One of the most striking facts of history is men's failure to learn from it. For further details, see the policies of the present administration. August 1962. The role of labor unions. Do labor unions raise the general standard of living? One of the most widespread delusions of our age is the belief that the American worker owes his high standard of living to unions and to humanitarian labor legislation. This belief is contradicted by the most fundamental facts and principles of economics. Facts and principles which are systematically evaded by labor leaders, legislators, and intellectuals of the statist persuasion. A country's standard of living, including the wages of its workers, depends on the productivity of labor. High productivity depends on machines, inventions, and capital investment, which depend on the creative ingenuity of individual men, which requires for its exercise a politico-economic system that protects the individual's rights and freedom. The productive value of physical labor as such is low. If the worker of today produces more than the worker of 50 years ago, it is not because the former exerts more physical effort. Quite the contrary. The physical effort required of him is far less. The productive value of his effort has been multiplied many times by the tools and machines with which he works. They are crucial in determining the economic worth of his services. To illustrate this principle, consider what would be a man's economic reward on a desert island for pushing his finger the distance of half an inch. Then consider the wages paid for pushing a button to an elevator operator in New York City. It is not muscles that make the difference. As Ludwig von Mises observes, American wages are higher than wages in other countries because the capital invested per head of the worker is greater, and the plants are thereby in the position to use the most efficient tools and machines. What is called the American way of life is the result of the fact that the United States has put fewer obstacles in the way of saving and capital accumulation than other nations. The economic backwardness of such countries as India consists precisely in the fact that their policies hinder both the accumulation of capital and the investment of foreign capital. As the capital required is lacking, the Indian enterprises are prevented from employing sufficient quantities of modern equipment, are therefore producing much less per man hour, and can only afford to pay wage rates which, compared with American wage rates, appear as shockingly low. In a free market economy, employers must bid competitively for the services of workers, just as they must bid competitively for all the other factors of production. If an employer attempts to pay wages which are lower than his workers can obtain elsewhere, he will lose his workers, and thus will be compelled to change his policy or go out of business. If other things being equal, an employer pays wages which are above the market level, His higher costs will put him at a competitive disadvantage in the sale of his products, and again he will be compelled to change his policy or go out of business. Employers do not lower wages because they are cruel, nor raise wages because they are kind. Wages are not determined by the employer's whim. Wages are the prices paid for human labor, and like all other prices in a free economy, are determined by the law of supply and demand. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution and capitalism, wage rates have risen steadily as an inevitable economic consequence of rising capital accumulation, technological progress, and industrial expansion. As capitalism created countless new markets, so it created an ever-widening market for labor. It multiplied the number and kinds of jobs available, increased the demand and competition for the workers' services, and thus drove wage rates upward. It was the economic self-interest of employers that led them to raise wages and shorten working hours, not the pressure of labor unions. The 8-hour day was established in most American industries long before unions acquired any significant size or economic power. At a time when his competitors were paying their workers between $2 and $3 a day, Henry Ford offered $5 a day, thereby attracting the most efficient labor force in the country and thus raising his own production and profits. In the 1920s, when the labor movement in France and Germany was far more dominant than in the United States, the standard of living of the American worker was greatly superior. It was the consequence of economic freedom. Needless to say, men have a right to organize into unions, provided they do so voluntarily, that is, provided no one is forced to join. Unions can have value as fraternal organizations, or as a means of keeping members informed of current market conditions, or as a means of bargaining more effectively with employers, particularly in small, isolated communities. It may happen that an individual employer is paying wages that, in the overall market context, are too low. In such a case, a strike or the threat of a strike can compel him to change his policy, since he will discover that he cannot obtain an adequate labor force at the wages he offers. However, the belief that unions can cause a general rise in the standard of living is a myth. Today, the labor market is no longer free. Unions enjoy a unique, near-monopolistic power over many aspects of the economy. This has been achieved through legislation which has forced men to join unions whether they wish to or not, and forced employers to deal with these unions whether they wish to or not. As a consequence, wage rates in many industries are no longer determined by a free market. Unions have been able to force wages substantially above their normal market level. These are the social gains for which unions are usually given credit. In fact, however, the result of their policy has been A, a curtailment of production, B, widespread unemployment, and C, the penalizing of workers in other industries, as well as the rest of the population. A, with the rise of wage rates to inordinately high levels, production costs are such that cutbacks in production are often necessary. New undertakings become too expensive, and growth is hindered. At the increased costs, marginal producers, those who have been barely able to compete in the market, find themselves unable to remain in business. The overall result? Goods and services that would have been produced are not brought into existence. B. As a result of the high wage rates, employers can afford to hire fewer workers. As a result of curtailed production, employers need fewer workers. Thus, one group of workers obtains unjustifiably high wages at the expense of other workers who are unable to find jobs at all. This, in conjunction with minimum wage laws, is the cause of widespread unemployment. Unemployment is the inevitable result of forcing wage rates above their free market level. In a free economy in which neither employers nor workers are subject to coercion, wage rates always tend toward the level at which all those who seek employment will be able to obtain it. In a frozen, controlled economy, this process is blocked. As a result of allegedly pro-labor legislation and of the monopolistic power that labor unions enjoy, unemployed workers are not free to compete in the labor market by offering their services for less than the prevailing wage rates. Employers are not free to hire them. In the case of strikes, if unemployed workers attempted to obtain the jobs vacated by union strikers by offering to work for a lower wage, they often would be subjected to threats and physical violence at the hands of union members. These facts are as notorious as they are evaded in most current discussions of the unemployment problem, particularly by government officials. C. When market conditions are such that producers whose labor costs have risen cannot raise the prices of the goods they sell, a curtailment of production results, as indicated above, and the general population accordingly suffers a loss of potential goods and services. The notion that producers can absorb such wage increases by taking them out of profits without a detriment to future production is worse than economically naive. It is profits that make future production possible. The amount of profits that go not into investment, but into the producer's personal consumption, is negligible in the overall economic context. To the extent that market conditions do allow, producers whose labor costs have risen are obliged to raise the prices of their goods. Then workers in other industries find that their living costs have gone up, that they must now pay higher prices for the goods they purchase. Then they in turn demand a raise in their industries, which leads to new price rises, which leads to new wage increases, etc. Union leaders typically express indignation whenever prices are raised. The only prices they consider it moral to raise are the prices paid for labor, i.e., wages. Non-unionized workers, and the rest of the population generally, face this same steady rise in their living costs. They are made to subsidize the unjustifiably high wages of union workers and are the unacknowledged victims of the union's social gains. And one observes the spectacle of bricklayers receiving two or even three times the salary of office workers and professors. It cannot be sufficiently emphasized that it is not unionism as such, but government controls and regulations which make this state of affairs possible. In a free, unregulated economy, in a market from which coercion is barred, no economic group can acquire the power so to victimize the rest of the population. The solution does not lie in new legislation directed against unions, but in the repeal of the legislation that made the present evil possible. The inability of unions to achieve real widespread raises in wage rates, to raise the standard of living generally, is in part obscured by the phenomenon of inflation. As a consequence of the government's policy of deficit spending and credit expansion, the purchasing power of the monetary unit, the dollar, has diminished drastically across the years. Nominal wage rates have increased considerably more than real wage rates, that is, wages measured in terms of actual purchasing power. What has further served to obscure this issue is the fact that real wage rates have risen considerably since the start of the century. In spite of destructive and increasing governmental restraints on the freedom of production and trade, major advances in science, technology, and capital accumulation have been made and have raised the general standard of living. It should be added that these advances are less than would have occurred in a fully free economy, and as controls continue to tighten, such advances become slower and rarer. It is relevant to consider against what obstacles businessmen have had to fight and to go on producing when one hears labor leaders proclaiming in indignant tones the workers' right to a larger share of the national product. To paraphrase John Galt, a larger share provided by whom? Blank out. Economic progress, like every other form of progress, has only one ultimate source, man's mind, and can exist only to the extent that man is free to translate his thought into action. Let anyone who believes that a high standard of living is the achievement of labor unions and government controls ask himself the following question. If one had a time machine and transported the United Labor Chieftains of America plus 3 million government bureaucrats back to the 10th century, would they be able to provide the medieval serf with electric light, refrigerators, automobiles, and television sets? When one grasps that they would not, one should identify who and what made these things possible. Postscript. After completing the above, I noticed an article in the New York Times of September 8th that is too apropos to let pass without acknowledgement. The article entitled 10 UAW Leaders Find Unions Are Losing Members' Loyalty by Damon Stetson reports that executives of the United Automobile Workers met to discuss the problem of workers' increasing lack of loyalty to union leadership and union solidarity. One UAW official is quoted as declaring, "How can we get greater loyalty from the individual to the union? All the things we fought for, the corporation is now giving the workers. What we have to find are other things the workers want, which the employer is not willing to give him, and we have to develop our program around these things as reasons for belonging to the union." Is any comment necessary? November 1963. Public education. Should education be compulsory and tax-supported as it is today? The answer to this question becomes evident if one makes the question more concrete and specific, as follows. Should the government be permitted to remove children forcibly from their homes, with or without the parents' consent, and subject the children to educational training and procedures of which the parents may or may not approve? Should citizens have their wealth expropriated to support an educational system which they may or may not sanction, and to pay for the education of children who are not their own? To anyone who understands and is consistently committed to the principle of individual rights, the answer is clearly no. There are no moral grounds whatever for the claim that education is the prerogative of the state, or for the claim that it is proper to expropriate the wealth of some men for the unearned benefit of others. The doctrine that education should be controlled by the state is consistent with the Nazi or communist theory of government. It is not consistent with the American theory of government. This book is continued on Disc 4.